Hey, I'm Sean McPherson from The Current, and earlier I had the opportunity to sit down with a true hip-hop legend and an absolute gentleman. DJ Jazzy Jeff has been a part of my life since music has been a part of my life. The first cassette I ever bought, or rather begged my mom to buy, was He's the DJ, I'm the Rapper. And I fell in love with the music, and I also fell in love with the personalities of the Fresh Prince and Jazzy Jeff. And he was such a part of those records beyond just his incredible production and DJ skills. He was a part of the songs. He would have interludes. He would speak during the songs. And to sit down and speak, granted via phone, with a legend like that is just a true career highlight for me, a life highlight for me. And also, the guy was just so open about struggles in the business world, struggles in the DJ world, but also sort of his incredible business acumen and his ability to make sure that he and his entourage and groups are in the right spaces for the type of music they make. It's a pretty inspiring interview, so I'm excited to play you this conversation I had with DJ Jazzy Jeff. And right off the top, I just start telling him about this first cassette I had. So I'll bring you into the conversation there. The first thing I got to tell you, Jeff, is that the actual first piece of media I ever bought related to hip hop was He's the DJ, I'm the Rapper.
I love it.
And I was born in 1981, so I was like a very, very young guy when I got that. And probably like a lot of folks, I got that record because I saw Parents Just Don't Understand on TV, and that was my first entry into it. But I wanted to focus on the fact that that also means the very first live hip hop I ever consumed in any way was live at Union Square in 1986. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about if it was an uphill battle to convince Jive and the other folks to put something like that on a record. And then B, talk about the experience of hip hop shows at that time coming up in Philadelphia and then starting to travel to New York as well.
You know what? It wasn't really a battle for them to put it on. What actually happened was, you know, when we started going to New York, you know, of course, by New York being the mecca of hip hop, we were always a little nervous because we were from Philly and you wanted to kind of be accepted. And what we knew is that they love DJs in New York. So Will always wanted me to open up the show with a DJ routine because he felt like we could get everybody on our side if we did it. And just so happened when we did Live at Union Square, Mr. Magic was there, Marley Marl was there, Red Alert was there. So all of the New York royalty were in the place. And Mr. Magic recorded it. And we didn't know that. It was a typical show for us, you know, open up with the DJ stuff. And then Ready Rock C comes on and does the human beatbox. And we do two of our records and we're out. So we did the show. People went crazy at the show, and we left, and someone told me that Mr. Magic played the cassette on the radio that week, and it became the biggest requested thing in New York, that everybody wanted to hear the live set of Live at Union Square. So when we heard that, we basically contacted Mr. Magic and asked him if he would give us a copy of the recording, and we were like, yo, why don't we just put this on He's the DJ, I'm the Rapper? You know, I think the reason why it made it was because we weren't paying attention at all to the structure. We broke so many rules on live on He's the DJ, I'm the Rapper. You know, for us to even think that we could grab a cassette tape and just clean it up as much as we can and put that on an album that came out was ridiculous. And I think that you know, that no holds barred and us being totally inexperienced and putting out music like that, you know, proved to be a very big benefit for us.
You mentioned sort of feeling like the underdogs coming from Philadelphia and going up to New York City. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I was probably watching BET 15 years ago and Black Thought was getting interviewed. And he said, I think Philadelphia MCs always come harder because we have this chip on our shoulder from not being from New York. Now, you probably, maybe you can imagine what that felt like watching it in Minneapolis. And I was like, wait, Philadelphia feels like they're the underdogs? Being that you came out of Philadelphia, an incredible musical legacy, which I know you actually have some straight family connections to, but obviously some incredible rappers and DJs and beyond have come out of there. What did that chip on your shoulder do to you guys as you started traveling to New York? Like, how did that impact, beyond opening with a DJ set, how else did it impact your career outlook?
Well, you know what was funny is I was telling someone yesterday that a lot of times we DJed at parties. I came up in the 80s and DJing at parties, because if the DJ was good, there was never any trouble. No one would fight. There would never be any, you know, disagreements, because everybody was so focused on the music. The only time people fought at the party, if the DJ sucked and it took too much attention away from, you know, the party, that everybody started getting in trouble. But I think that basically helped us, because, you know, us joking, like, we played so people wouldn't fight. When we got to New York, it wasn't as difficult as it was in Philly. So us coming with this drive, like, okay, we got to go hard. We got to make sure that we, everything that we do is A1. People were blown away at how tight we were. And it was kind of like, you know, I'm used to spinning at parties for 2 hours and somebody wants us to do a 20-minute show. You were kind of like, this is a piece of cake. Like, all I have to do is pick out the best stuff that we do. We perform our records. Let's put a little twist on our records, and we're done. So when we started going out, and basically not only New York, but start going around the country performing, we kind of found it easy, because Philadelphia was so hard to please that it was kind of like, wow, like, if this is how it's going to be, this is going to be great.
Well, and it's not bad to switch from doing 2 hour sets to just doing 20 minute sets. I imagine that probably
at all.
Now, you, beyond being a real innovator in production and obviously an incredible part of a number of musical projects and doing studio production with Touch of Jazz, etc., you also are pretty well known for something that actually gets featured on Live at Union Square, which is this Transformer scratch. And I did my turntable homework today and got to watch Q-Bert freaking out about you explaining how you did it with DJ Revolution and all that. For somebody who didn't spend the, you know, 2 hours on YouTube today, could you explain briefly how you came up with the Transformer scratch?
Well, one of the things that I want to clarify is I didn't technically come up with it. There was a DJ in Philadelphia named Spinbad who was the first person that I saw do anything remotely similar to it. But with the entire DJ culture, it was somebody doing something and you looking at what they're doing, and you decide to take what they're doing and put a twist to it. So basically all I did, you know, with DJs like Cash Money in Philadelphia, Lightning Rich in Philadelphia, is we just took what Spinbad did that was very basic and basically put a lot of rhythm to it. So all it really is cutting on and off the signal in a rhythmic manner. So it's almost like someone cutting on and off, or cutting up and down a volume that in very short bursts, but you're doing it like you're playing a drum pattern. So if it was a straight sound, you made the sound go so everyone would freak out, because you were basically playing almost musical patterns or drum patterns with just a scratch sound instead of just letting it go and doing an open fader scratch. You know, to be able to take that and then put that on wax, that's what kind of took it, you know, worldwide. That's pretty much all it was. It's like you were taking something that you did at a house party in front of 50 people, and we got a chance to make a record, and it was kind of like, hey, I want to do this on the record, and you do it on the record, and you don't realize that the record was going to sell 3 million copies, and everybody was going to know about this.
But if you could only scratch with one sound, what sound, you know, what little piece to scratch with would you bring along with you on your DJ gigs?
Most people on earth would say the Change the Beat record, which is the Ah and the Fresh. But I would probably say Shannon Let the Music Play 12-inch, because it has a whoosh sound in the beginning of it and a very loud crash that I've always got a kick out of scratching.
That's a good answer. I was ready for the more predictable one, but like always, you've had a career that kind of defies logic in the most beautiful ways. Because when everyone thinks you're just going to stay behind the turntables, you've been in the, you know, recording studio. You've done comedy work, obviously, with your former partner, the Fresh Prince. So okay, I'll have to pick up that record, because I don't have that one. You've been traveling a lot lately, as a DJ mm-hmm. performing at a lot of different functions, and I've been following some of the stuff that I've seen online with the group that travels with you. Mm-hmm. Have you ever ran into a situation? I read something about DJ Shadow maybe 2 years ago where he had a gig in Las Vegas, and think you're getting brought to be this legit celebrity, incredibly talented DJ, and then the club manager kind of treats you like, oh, sorry, I thought you were going to play more EDM. We're going to cut your set early. Have you ever had something where you had a misunderstanding where somebody thought they were booking just a DJ and they didn't realize that they were booking somebody who had kind of their own style mandate, if you know what I mean?
You know what? I've been blessed that a lot of people know what I do and how I do it, but I have had situations like that. I had a situation, we were on a tour that was a DJ tour that had gone to a number of places, and we ended up going through Kansas City playing this outdoor venue. And, you know, I basically came about 10 minutes before my set. Z-Trip went on before I did, and I came on and started playing this set. And my sets are, you know, I am not genre-specific at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I am kind of like, if it moves you, I'll play it. I'll throw curveballs in. I play a number of different styles of music. And I started playing this set, and I noticed at the time that my road manager kept coming out bringing me bottles of water. And this was maybe about 15 minutes in the set. And when he brought the second bottle, I'm looking like, okay, I have a bottle of water already. And then he brought a third bottle, and I looked at him funny, and his eyes were really big. And he walked over to me, and he said, they don't want you playing any hip hop. Now, the interesting thing is I just got finished playing Biz Is Just a Friend, which it was 10,000 people singing along, and I was playing Rihanna. So he was like, they don't allow hip hop played in the venue, and they're about to cut you. He said, I wanted to tell you because I wanted you to have a chance to stop before they cut you. So I looked at him and I said, okay. And we leaned over, and I told the MC, and he said, okay. And right in the middle, I just pushed stop, and he made the announcement that we just got word that they don't like playing hip-hop in this venue. We're very, very sorry. We had something very special for you, but they were about to cut us. And before they cut us, we'd like to just say we are sorry and sign off. And the venue freaked out because they were just basically going to cut the set. They were mad that we got a chance to basically tell everyone before that, and it was pandemonium that they ended up issuing a massive apology. But, you know, in the beginning, they were like, you know, Jeff blew the speakers and, you know, and we never said that because we weren't supposed to get that information. So I understand, like, and it was very weird to get to a point where you start having these issues. And there are places that I won't play because I've heard situations like that. You know, I'm kind of like, as well respected as DJ Shadow is, and how if you do any investigation work on DJ Shadow, you know exactly what kind of DJ he is. Right. So I really don't understand someone who would book him to play something other than who DJ Shadow is.
Yeah.
Like somebody in the club world didn't do their due diligence when it came to someone like him. But I have a team of people around me that we pay attention to that. Like, I know that I never try to fit a round peg in a square hole. You know, I played a couple of places in Las Vegas that, you know, right in the middle of your set with thousands of people dancing, having a good time because someone bought a $3,000 bottle of champagne, they want you to stop the music and cater to them. And I understand that that is the Vegas culture. So I choose not to play Vegas.
Is there any records that you're more likely to pull out when you're playing Minneapolis than otherwise? Are there any sort of things you've learned as being Minneapolis favorites?
It's almost cliche. Like, if you come to Philly, I want to play Summertime by Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince. I want to play something from Gamble and Huff. Because Prince is from Minneapolis and Morris Day and the Time and just the entire Minneapolis music scene, you almost feel like it's cliche to come there and play that. Like, being from Philadelphia, you know, I judged the Red Bull 3-style U.S. competition in Philadelphia, and it was absolutely amazing how many DJs came to try to do something for Philadelphia. And it's kind of like, you know what? We live here.
Right.
We live here. We get Gamble and Huff all day long. We get Beanie Siegel and Freeway and Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince all day long. I want you to do something different. So I am not really the person that's like, oh, my God, I'm coming to Minneapolis. Let me put together my Prince set. Like, if I was going to play something, I would naturally play it because I wouldn't deviate from what I would do. But I am not, you know, you know what's funny? And I learned this from traveling around the globe, that you go to Australia and they brought you to Australia because they want you to do what you do. Like, it's almost like you go to Australia and you play like an Australian DJ. And they're kind of like, we brought you 12,000 miles not to do what we get all of the time. We want you to do you. So, you know, I find myself a lot of times not necessarily deviating from what I normally do anywhere. You know, because, you know, I know people is like, oh, you know, I'm going to play a fan favorite. You know, I understand that. But when you start trying to play according to your environment, it kind of takes you out of the reason why people brought you there.
A lot of times people who really got their stripes as DJs, their production style will often seem to be really based on relatively choppy sounds. Now, this isn't exclusive, but I'm particularly thinking of somebody like DJ Premier, where I really hear the sort of the aesthetic of turntables in the production. And your work is really quite different. So I just listened to Two Step, and it's got heavy synthesizer work, and that's something that I associate with you production style wise. And I was just trying to make sense of the fact that you come out of this DJ culture, but your records that you produce often sound more like a keyboard player. And I was trying to understand where that comes from.
I am a keyboard player at heart. I grew up in the era of the DJ. If I'd have grew up 10 years earlier, I would probably have been a keyboard player, a bass player, or a guitar player. So I've always considered myself a musician first. I'm a musician who knows how to DJ. So when it comes time for me to make music, I am a music lover. You know, I love chords. I love blues chords. I love R&B soul chords. I love jazz chords. I love emotion, anything emotionally with music that can, you know, give you goosebumps. That's what I'm really drawn to. So when it comes time for me to make music, I don't really necessarily think I have a middle ground. I'm either going to give you the hardest beats in the world for you to nod your head, or I'm going to give you something that's very warm and lush.
Talking about other sort of landmark moments in your career, I could have sworn to God before I did the preparation for this interview that when you guys received the Grammy in 1989 for 1988, A, that it was televised, and B, that you and Will Smith were both up there. And then I find out, no, it was just Jazzy Jeff who went to the ceremony and it wasn't televised. I have this memory burnt in my head of Fresh Prince going, it's 1988, it's our year, from an award show, but I don't know where that comes from. What did you feel winning this Grammy, but it also being very convoluted as far as it not being televised, and there's sort of this feeling of being, oh, we're going to give out a rap Grammy, but we're not going to give it the respect it deserves?
Well, I'm going to tell you what's funny. I think what you're talking about, that I was there and Will wasn't, was in 1993. Both of us boycotted in 1989. It was the biggest joy to be acknowledged for a record, but it was the biggest letdown when they said, we're not going to televise it. And our thing wasn't to discredit any other music, but I'm kind of like, okay, you have 12 country and Western categories. There's one rap category. That, you know, no disrespect to country and Western, but you can't make them have 11 and give us one, when especially I can almost guarantee you, because we did the research, that in 1988, 1989, hip-hop was the top-selling music. And we felt disrespected, especially this is at a time that we were fighting for legitimacy. Like, we didn't know. There were people like Rick Dees, who was very well respected, you know, that went on Arsenio Hall, and he asked him, you know, well, what is the new trend? And he said, well, the new trend is hip-hop is dead. So for someone that's what you do, your life is hip-hop music, for someone to discredit it like that, we were fighting for legitimacy. So when the Grammys said that they weren't going to televise it, we all banded together. It was like, nope, we can't do that. We have to make some kind of a stand to make sure that this never happens again, because we're trying to preserve the music that we're doing.
I'm just going to ask you one geek out question before.
Absolutely.
For a long time, everyone thought that when they went and checked the credits, we were going to find out that Rakim ghost wrote Summertime. and that's not the case. And that seems definitive to me.
That is nowhere close to the case.
Now,
it's very interesting now. It's really interesting being a part of something and getting 20, 30 years later and hearing all of these folk stories. Like, I realized that, you know, as time goes on, sometimes people tend to make up stuff. But I was in the studio. There was no Rakim at all in the studio. It wasn't even a thought. The only thing, I gave Will an instruction to not be excited. Will has a tendency to be very hyper with records. And Summertime was such a down-tempo, feel-good record that it was kind of like, yo, don't scream. Keep your voice in a very low monotone thing. And I think that was the thing that shocked everybody, because that's not Boom Shake the Room. That's not right. Some of the records that we've done. It was, he changed his vocal style more than anything to fit the track. And I think that's where the comparison started to come in, because that's Rakim's style on everything. Rakim doesn't know how to be excited.
Right. And that's what I kind of, I mean, I knew going into this that it was an urban legend. What I was trying to figure out is what you as the producer of the track did to channel Will into this lane he had never been in before, and to my mind really hasn't been in since. Different tone, different register, and different writing style. So apparently you're really just saying the guidance was, hey, mellow out a little bit, and that's where he got to that. It's incredible, man. It is, you know, I'm sure that as much as there's a lot of DJs that maybe come to Philly and overplay it, there's a lot of DJs that come to everywhere and overplay that song once it hits Memorial Day. It's time to play Summertime on the radio and time to play Summertime at every block party. And I appreciate you making just an absolute timeless classic.
Will and I were talking not too long ago, and I told him, I was just like, you know what's crazy? You go your career to hope that you make something timeless. Like, there are a lot of incredible artists that make great records that don't necessarily stand the test of time. And I was like, every summer, I'm waiting for Summertime to die. Like the second year after Summertime, I was kind of like, okay, that was cool. You might get somebody to play it. But I didn't think it was going to start all over again. Oh, my God, here we go. It's Summertime. We got to play it. So to have something that you say, listen, it was 1993 when we released this record, and every summer it's the summer anthem. Like, that is a blessing beyond compare, because that's what everybody hopes that they have. And the extra blessing on top of it is we have that with the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air also.
Right.
That you have a TV show that kids, you know, who grew up with that show, have kids now who watch the reruns of that show. And I remember saying to him, like, yo, do you realize we did it twice? Like, who does that? Like, if it's all downhill from here, there's absolutely nothing that we could ever say.
You got at least three classics, because I got a niece who just went into kindergarten, and her favorite thing to say if I'm playing the stereo is, Mom, Dad, how was your trip? So you guys you have staying power beyond those things. Is Summertime the best thing to see show up on the royalty statements? Is that the strongest one as far as catalog goes?
Oh, like, see, that now that was a very touchy You know what's very interesting and very sad at the same time is we don't see royalty statements from Summertime.
Did Kool and the Gang take all?
No, okay. No, not at all. The music business is a very, very cruel business. And it's never been fair to the artist.
Right.
And I don't want to get so deep on the soapbox, but I have always fought because something just never seemed right. As happy as I was making music, I never understood how you can be the composer of something, you can put something together, you can go in the studio and you can record it, and you can even go out on the road and support it and perform it. But when it comes to the actual sales, you're fortunate if you got 8%.
Yeah.
And what happens is, I think this is where sometimes what I try to explain to people, when you wonder where your favorite artists are, most of the people who have had any dealings in record companies are very heartbroken, because it's realizing that Santa Claus is not real. You think that this is something that's going to absolutely change your life and you're going to ride off into the sunset. You know, I tell people, you know, I do a lot of seminars and talking, you know, about the music industry, that over the course of Will and myself's career, we may have sold close to 10 million records. And at $9.99, you know, retail price, you basically made a record company close to $100 million. And I would be shocked if between Will and myself, we saw $3 million of that. So you get, you know, and then you get to a point that, you know, we ended up in a nasty dispute with the record company when we were trying to leave. And in order for us to kind of break away and Will kind of go to Sony, that we had to give up all of the rights to the music that we made. So there's a level of bittersweetness that, yep, we made these incredible records and people love them, but we see absolutely nothing from them.
God, I had no idea. I mean, I've heard those horror stories from other folks and, frankly, from some label mates of yours, including A Tribe Called Quest. But I did not know that about I did not know that about your catalog. And I'm just so you know, I'm on the side of you and Will deserving a lot more of that money than just $3 million. And I didn't know that.
I'm going to tell you, one of the things that I will say that was also kind of bittersweet was what people didn't realize was when we left Jive and Will went to Sony, I chose not to sign a record deal. Like, I was so heartbroken from, you know, getting to the end of this deal. We spent 10 years at Jive with all of this success, and instead of getting a gold watch, we got a lawsuit. Yeah. I was so hurt behind that I was like, I do not want to be signed to anyone. I want to be free. So that's why I had involvement in every last one of Will's solo albums. Whenever you saw Will perform, I was there. I just wasn't there on paper.
Yeah, I never caught the vibe from you guys like it was a really, like it was an ever a nasty thing between you two. It just seemed like
We never broke up. Yeah. Like, people would be like, oh, did you and Will break up? And it was kind of like, no, like, you've never seen Will perform and I wasn't there. It's always been Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. I just didn't want a Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince on paper anymore because I couldn't take that.
Yeah.
But what I loved was we felt like Jive stopped believing in us. Like, we felt like Jive basically threw us in the trash. So to come out with Will's first solo endeavor was Wild Wild West, which sold 5 million copies. And the second endeavor was Big Willie Styles, which ended up at about 27 million copies. It was almost retribution of someone who feels like you're done. You're done. We just basically threw you in the trash and we don't want to have anything to do with you. And you basically are looking at someone like, if you would have just believed in the talent, this could have been yours. But to look at it like that, if we were getting 8%, I don't know if I wanted 26 million records to get 8% of that.
That's fair. It's if the deal's so bad, you kind of want the thing to tank just because you're not going to benefit from it anyway.
Yeah.
Jeff, I'm humbled to speak to you. You're a huge part of my development and my genesis as a hip-hop fan, and I appreciate everything you've done in the studios in your life, on stages in your life, and I appreciate you spending the time to chat today, and I hope you have a great time in Minneapolis.
I appreciate it, man, definitely.